Page 55. Starting Chapter 8. What slaves are taught to think of the North. Slaveholders pride themselves upon being honorable men, but if you were to hear the enormous lies they tell their slaves, you would have small respect for their veracity. I have spoken plain English. Pardon me. I cannot use a milder term. When they visit the North and return home, they tell their slaves of the runaways they have seen, and describe them to be in the most deplorable condition. A slaveholder once told me that he had seen a runaway friend of mine in New York, and that she besought him to take her back to her master, for she was literally dying of starvation, that many days she had only one cold potato to eat, and at other times could get nothing at all. He said he refused to take her because he knew her master would not thank him for bringing such a miserable wretch to his house. He ended by saying to me, "This is the punishment she brought on herself for running away from a kind master." This whole story was false. I afterward stayed with that friend in New York and found her in comfortable circumstances. She had never thought of such a thing as wishing to go back to slavery. Many of the slaves believe such stories and think it is not worth while to exchange slavery for such a hard kind of freedom. It is difficult to persuade such that freedom could make them useful men and enable them to protect their wives and children. If those heathen in our Christian land had as much teaching as some Hindus, they would think otherwise. They would know that liberty is more valuable than life. They would begin to understand their own capabilities and exert themselves to become men and women. Page 56. But while the free states sustain a law which hurls fugitives back into slavery, how can the slaves resolve to become men? There are some who strive to protect wives and daughters from the insults of their masters, but those who have such sentiments have had advantages above the general mass of slaves. They have been partially civilized and Christianized by favorable circumstances. Some are bold enough to utter such sentiments to their masters. Oh, that there were more of them! Some poor creatures have been so brutalized by the lash that they will sneak out of the way to give their masters free access to their wives and daughters. Do you think this proves the black man to belong to an inferior order of beings? What would you be if you had been born and brought up a slave, with generations of slaves for ancestors? I admit that the black man is inferior, but what is it that makes him so? It is the ignorance in which white men compel him to live. It is the torturing whip that lashes manhood out of him. It is the fierce bloodhounds of the South and the scarcely less cruel human bloodhounds of the North who enforce the fugitive slave law. They do the work. Southern gentlemen indulge in the most contemptuous expressions about the Yankees, while they, on their part, consent to do the vilest work for them, such as the ferocious bloodhounds and the despised Negro hunters are employed to do at home. When Southerners go to the North, they are proud to do them honor, but the Northern man is not welcome south of Mason and Dixon's line unless he suppresses every thought and feeling at variance with their peculiar institution. Nor is it enough to be silent. The masters are not pleased unless they obtain a greater degree of subservience than that, and they are generally accommodated. Do they respect the Northerner for this? I trow not. Even the slaves despise a Northern man with Southern principles, and that is the class they generally see. When Northerners go to the South to reside, they prove very apt scholars. They soon imbibe the sentiments and dispositions of their neighbors, and generally go beyond their teachers. Of the two, they are proverbially the hardest masters. Page 57. They seem to satisfy their consciences with the doctrine that God created the Africans to be slaves. What a libel upon the Heavenly Father, who made of one blood all nations of men. And then, who are Africans? Who can measure the amount of Anglo-Saxon blood coursing in the veins of American slaves? I have spoken of the pains slaveholders take to give their slaves a bad opinion of the North. But notwithstanding this, intelligent slaves are aware that they have many friends in the free states. Even the most ignorant have some confused notions about it. They knew that I could read, and I was often asked if I had seen anything in the newspapers about white folks over in the Big North who were trying to get their freedom for them. Some believe that the abolitionists have already made them free, and that it is established by law, but that their masters prevent the law from going into effect. One woman begged me to get a newspaper and read it over. She said her husband told her that the black people had sent word to the Queen of America that they were all slaves, that she didn't believe it, and went to Washington City to see the president about it. They quarreled. She drew her sword upon him and swore that he should help her to make them all free. That poor ignorant woman thought that America was governed by a queen to whom the president was subordinate. I wish the president was subordinate to Queen Justice. Page 58 is blank. Page 59. Starting chapter 9. Sketches of neighboring slaveholders. There was a planter in the country not far from us, whom I will call Mr. Litch. He was an ill-bred, uneducated man, but very wealthy. He had 600 slaves, many of whom he did not know by sight. His extensive plantation was managed by well-paid overseers. There was a jail and a whipping post on his grounds, and whatever cruelties were perpetrated there, they passed without comment. He was so effectually screened by his great wealth that he was called to no account for his crimes, not even for murder. Various were the punishments resorted to. A favorite one was to tie a rope round a man's body and suspend him from the ground. A fire was kindled over him, from which was suspended a piece of fat pork. As this cooked, the scalding drops of fat continually fell on the bare flesh. On his own plantation, he required very strict obedience to the Eighth Commandment. But depredations on the neighbors were allowable, provided the culprit managed to evade detection or suspicion. If a neighbor brought a charge of theft against any of his slaves, he was browbeaten by the master, who assured him that his slaves had enough of everything at home and had no inducement to steal. No sooner was the neighbor's back turned than the accused was sought out and whipped for his lack of discretion. If a slave stole from him even a pound of meat or a peck of corn, if detection followed, he was put in chains and imprisoned, and so kept till his form was attenuated by hunger and suffering. A freshet once bore his wine cellar and meat house miles away from the plantation. Some slaves followed and secured bits of meat and bottles of wine. Page 60. Two were detected, a ham and some liquor being found in their huts. They were summoned by their master. No words were used, but a club fell them to the ground. A rough box was their coffin, and their interment was a dog's burial. Nothing was said. Murder was so common on his plantation that he feared to be alone after nightfall. He might have believed in ghosts. His brother, if not equal in wealth, was at least equal in cruelty. His bloodhounds were well trained. Their pen was spacious and a terror to the slaves. They were let loose on a runway, and if they tracked him, they literally tore the flesh from his bones. When this slaveholder died, his shrieks and groans were so frightful that they appalled his own friends. His last words were, "I am going to hell. Bury my money with me." After death, his eyes remained open. To press the lids down, silver dollars were laid on them. These were buried with him. From this circumstance, a rumor went abroad that his coffin was filled with money. Three times his grave was opened and his coffin taken out. The last time, his body was found on the ground, and a flock of buzzards were pecking at it. He was again interred, and a sentinel set over his grave. The perpetrators were never discovered. Cruelty is contagious in uncivilized communities. Mr. Conant, a neighbor of Mr. Litch, returned from town one evening in a partial state of intoxication. His body servant gave him some offense. He was divested of his clothes, except his shirt, whipped and tied to a large tree in front of the house. It was a stormy night in winter. The wind blew bitterly cold, and the boughs of the old tree crackled under falling sleet. A member of the family, fearing he would freeze to death, begged that he might be taken down, but the master would not relent. He remained there 3 hours, and when he was cut down, he was more dead than alive. Another slave, who stole a pig from his master to appease his hunger, was terribly flogged. In desperation, he tried to run away, but at the end of 2 miles, he was so faint with loss of blood, he thought he was dying. He had a wife, and he longed to see her once more. Page 61. Too sick to walk, he crept back that long distance on his hands and knees. When he reached his master's, it was night. He had not strength to rise and open the gate. He moaned and tried to call for help. I had a friend living in the same family. At last his cry reached her. She went out and found the prostrate man at the gate. She ran back to the house for assistance, and the two men returned with her. They carried him in and laid him on the floor. The back of his shirt was one clot of blood. By means of lard, my friend loosened it from the raw flesh. She bandaged him, gave him cool drink, and left him to rest. The master said he deserved 100 more lashes. When his own labor was stolen from him, he had stolen food to appease his hunger. This was his crime. Another neighbor was a Mrs. Wade. At no hour of the day was there cessation of the lash on her premises. Her labors began with the dawn, and did not cease till long after nightfall. The barn was her particular place of torture. There she lashed the slaves with the might of a man. An old slave of hers once said to me, "It is hell in Mrs. House. Piers, I can never get out. Day and night I prays to die." The mistress died before the old woman, and when dying entreated her husband not to permit any one of her slaves to look on her after death. A slave who had nursed her children and had still a child in her care, watched her chance and stole with it in her arms to the room where lay her dead mistress. She gazed a while on her, then raised her hand and dealt 2 blows on her face, saying, as she did so, "The devil is got you now." She forgot that the child was looking on. She had just begun to talk, and she said to her father, "I did see Ma, and Mammy did strike Ma, so," striking her own face with her little hand. The master was startled. He could not imagine how the nurse could obtain access to the room where the corpse lay, for he kept the door locked. He questioned her. She confessed that what the child had said was true, and told how she had procured the key. She was sold to Georgia. "In my childhood, I knew a valuable slave named Charity, and loved her as all children did." Page 62. Her young mistress married and took her to Louisiana. Her little boy James was sold to a good sort of master. He became involved in debt, and James was sold again to a wealthy slaveholder, noted for his cruelty. With this man, he grew up to manhood, receiving the treatment of a dog. After a severe whipping to save himself from further infliction of the lash with which he was threatened, he took to the woods. He was in a most miserable condition, cut by the cowskin, half naked, half starved, and without the means of procuring a crust of bread. Some weeks after his escape, he was captured, tied, and carried back to his master's plantation. This man considered punishment in his jail on bread and water, after receiving hundreds of lashes too mild for the poor slave's offense. Therefore, he decided, after the overseer should have whipped him to his satisfaction, to have him placed between the screws of the cotton gin, to stay as long as he had been in the woods. This wretched creature was cut with the whip from his head to his feet, then washed with strong brine to prevent the flesh from mortifying and make it heal sooner than it otherwise would. He was then put into the cotton gin, which was screwed down, only allowing him room to turn on his side when he could not lie on his back. Every morning a slave was sent with a piece of bread and bowl of water, which was placed within reach of the poor fellow. The slave was charged under penalty of severe punishment not to speak to him. 4 days passed, and the slave continued to carry the bread and water. On the second morning he found the bread gone, but the water untouched. When he had been in the press 4 days and 5 nights, the slave informed his master.